The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Most of us already know that the media manipulates us. It makes us think that we need products that we don't really have a use for. It creates the appearance of scientific controversy where there is none. And it often reduces complex ideas to overly simplistic sound bites. But on today's episode, we'll talk about just how radically this affects your view of the world. How many of your fears are based on misrepresented statistics, biased reporting, and the media's love of a good story. We'll be joined by Barry Glassner, author of the book, The Culture of Fear. And keeping with the theme, here's Greg Layton with Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. We're here with evolutionary anthropologist Greg Layton for another episode of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, how are you?
Good.
So today's falsehood is the poor have more babies than others. So, as always in this segment, that isn't quite accurate.
That's right. As is the case with pretty much all the falsehoods we're looking at, it's a statement that is often true, but what we want to look at is really two things. One is, when you say that out loud in a room of people, you know, what thoughts occur to people? What is that invoking in people's minds? What is the real meaning of actually saying out loud, oh, those poor people are having more babies than everyone else? Is it accurate? And what is the meaning behind it? And also, what's not being said? Or is it true that only poor people have more babies? Are they the only ones with high fertility? And so on. I think it's probably worth it to sort of frame this broadly to think about fertility. You know, fertility is the number of babies that a woman has. It doesn't relate to how many babies she can have. We know that humans have a potential of having a very high fertility rate. In the Midwestern United States and Canada in the 19th century, when Eastern farmers came into the region, they had fertility rates that were off the charts. There were men that were having dozens of children with several different wives sequentially because the women would just have baby after baby after baby and finally die from it. Because of the environment that they were in and the economy that they were, different regions of the world have different fertility. Different ethnicities maybe have different fertilities. Religion is a factor. Socioeconomic status. Patriarchy matters. In societies where men can sort of force women to do things more than other societies, they often want their wives to have more children than the women want to have, and you end up with a conflict like that. So it's a big question, and you hardly ever hear in just common conversations people say, oh yeah, those rich people over in France, you know, I heard they have a lot of kids, as opposed to the regular people in France.
Right.
Or you only hear about poor people. And I guess with a lot of these falsehoods, the reason I even have written about it and talked about it is because of something that happened in a classroom where I refer to a paper written by a woman named Susan Essoc Vitale. It was written in the 1980s. The paper was called The Reproductive Success of Wealthy Americans, in which she documented the fact that the wealthiest Americans had higher fertility than the average Americans for a period of about 10 years prior, so like the mid-70s through the mid-80s. And I just mentioned this in connection with behavioral biology and talking about mammalian mating systems and elephant seals and ground squirrels and humans and primates. And it just came up, and several of the students got mad at me. They got mad because they knew it wasn't true. They knew that, no, poor people are the ones having more babies. Rich people have fewer babies. And they had a model in their mind of wealth to poor and rich to and low to high fertility. Later on, I encountered that same idea in Philip Rushton's writings about race, in which he claims that white people have lower fertility and longer gestation periods, and black people have higher fertility and shorter gestation periods, which is not true, and a whole bunch of other things that basically compare races with a kind of RK strategy thing, where you have sort of civilized races and more animalistic races. So it's an idea that has a lot of meaning and just permeates a lot of different kinds of very tricky and important discussions about humans.
Well, so you say that there's actually data that does show that at least in America that wealthy people on average have more children than the general population?
Well, the American case is actually a mild example. Americans are relatively egalitarian and relatively homogeneous culturally in a lot of ways. And we don't really have a fully blown caste system. And we don't have, you know, the most extreme examples of high fertility related to wealth are despotic leaders. There's quite a bit of literature on this in the behavioral biology world now, where you have a despotic leader of some country, and there's actually a staff of people in charge of bringing women to him in the proper sequence while they're fertile so that he can father several thousand offspring, you know, that kind of thing. And that's an example of extreme wealth equaling extreme fertility to the extent that everyone else doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what anyone else does. You've got, in history, we know of several hundred guys who each have had 5,000 children, and it just wipes out any other comparison you can make. And to the extent that we almost have to ignore that data because it's so extreme, yet it's not terribly uncommon. It's not. Throughout history, there's been lots and lots and lots of that. There's a person who I won't name, even though it's well known, but I just rather not name him, who's a fairly famous person who at one time was in, he might have been the richest person in North America for a while, or he was up there in the top five for several years. And again, around the time that I was writing and talking about this with students, it became known that he had two families. He was in the Estock Fidelia study. He was one of the people in there who already had a higher fertility rate. He had like four or five kids. Turns out he had 8 or 10 kids because there was just this other family he had elsewhere, and they were middle class, and they were just sort of kept on the side. So we don't have despotic leaders in America having thousands of children as far as we know, but there is that effect. The other thing, that the more important part of this, is to recognize that it is not true that poor people have higher fertility rates. What happens is people who immigrate into any country from any other country take with them their fertility rate from their old country. Typically, this has been like demonstrated in a number of cases. People immigrate into North America from England. They show up with whatever their fertility rate was in England. They come from Nigeria. They come with that fertility rate. And they keep that fertility rate for a while. And as a generation passes, it shifts to local conditions. Because fertility is not determined by your genes or your ethnic background. It's determined by the conditions you're in. And as they become working class Canadians or middle class Americans or something, they adopt that fertility rate in a generation or so. So at any given time, there's always some group of people that's immigrated into North America, and you can always find them and say, look, they have a higher fertility rate because they come from a place with, you have to ask. The other thing is there's an accusation here. Those people have more children, and we're mad at them for doing that. That comes from a few different places, I think. And one is an old biblical tradition of, you know, telling your flock to have more children than the other tribe because we can then out-compete them. Mm-hmm. Or the kind of cuckoldry that comes from living in a welfare state, a state that actually does take tax money and distribute it to poor people. If we're rich, we're raising the children of the poor in some way. And people get mad about that kind of thing. But what's really interesting about that is the thing that causes fertility change is not people's innate sense of morality or their race or the genes inside them. It's the conditions they live in. In areas of Nigeria where outside NGOs have come in and implemented really pretty good rural healthcare systems, people's fertility rates went down. And they went down because they were high because of so many babies that died. People had more children because their chance of their children surviving to adulthood was very low. Mm-hmm. And when healthcare improves, that demographic transition happens, and you have women really don't want to have one baby every 22 months. You know, they'd really rather have just a few and have them all live. And that's what can happen. And so anybody can be in a situation where their fertility rate is either high or low. Another factor which is interesting is a lot of this idea of who's having more and fewer children emerged in a North American context culturally from the 70s when the post-baby boom period happened and a lot of people stopped having babies. The fact that medically North Americans are able to have babies pretty safely when they're in their 40s is because of a large amount of medical work that went into making that more possible, because in the 80s, so many women in their 40s decided to have babies. And they did so after a decade and a half or so of basically really low fertility. Hardly anybody had any babies relatively in middle-class America, for example, in the 1970s. The fertility rate was way down. So the fact that kind of the people you see on television, the people you see in day-to-day life, your teachers, the people who are just around that are kind of the models for other people in society are basically not having babies. They're not getting married at 18, having a baby at 19 anymore like they used to, is the other side of the coin. It's where fertility is dropping for various reasons. And you then pick and choose what you want to call normal, having lots of babies normal or having very few.
Well, then, but there's also the issue of attempting to compare the relative wealth of, let's say, a Nigerian family with a Canadian family.
Exactly. Measuring the fertility of, like, the human species around the world would be useful for only one thing, and that is a long-term demographic estimate of global population, and it wouldn't work very well because there would be so much variation in it. You can't compare the fertility of, if you just get away from humans for a minute and just take any variable, body size, food, dietary preferences, hunting patterns, or fertility of any mammal, you wouldn't mix up your data where you take five or six samples from the Adirondack Park of deer fertility and add in some Florida Key deer, you know, or for some other reason. You just wouldn't do it. You'd keep your data restricted to a single context, and maybe right. You would compare two contexts. But then when you try to compare them, you know, comparing fertility of humans are like a diversity of species. You know, it's kind of tricky to say this, but we live in so many habitats and so many different life ways and economies that we just don't, we're not well behaved as a species you'd want to study for any given purpose. You have to recognize that we have vastly different life ways and vastly different economies all around the world. And an agrarian society with no tractors is really different than an industrial society where half the people live in a city.
Right.
They're just so different that you might need to compare them for some reason. But to compare a single variable and say that that's a meaningful comparison isn't ever valid. And yeah, that's the poor people of Nigeria have way more babies than the middle class people of a Chicago suburb is a true statement that has no utility or meaning whatsoever.
So we wind up with this impression that the poor must be reproducing so much faster, but it's actually only supported by this basically invalid cross-cultural comparison then.
Right. And it's one of those things that when I've blogged about this, if you look at where I blogged about it and look at the comments, people will be showing, you know, coming up with data and showing high numbers of offspring of various groups of people around the world. And you can prove that poor people have more babies than other people. Because in fact, if you have an independent measure of socioeconomic status, people in third world countries tend to have higher fertility rates than people in industrialized countries. Just like the people in industrialized countries, fertility rates go up and down with economic situations as well. And so that's just going to be true. Just like people in third world countries tend to have much higher mortality rates from infectious disease because they don't have antibiotics and they have more
right.
less control over this. And so there's all kinds of statements you can make that are comparative like that. But it's not that being poor makes you have more babies. And it's not even the case when an immigrant group arrives in North America and they have a higher fertility rate and the next generation doesn't, it's not because they became wealthy. It's because they have changed, a lot of things have changed. And lower, the SES, the socioeconomic status of a group can stay the same and their fertility rate goes down. That's kind of, I think, a really important fact that I should have probably mentioned even earlier. That groups that come into the United States who have high fertility rates right away, their fertility rate drops quickly and their SES diversifies. People, some of those people get wealthier. Some people who become middle class, some are working class, and some are poor. That does not predict their fertility rate.
So why is that?
Probably because of healthcare and because of shifts in culture. I think that the shift in culture is important, but hard to measure, where you have a society which women, I'm a woman in America, I can decide whether or not to have a baby, is a factor. And then the fact that your babies are all going to live. Having said that, I just want to throw in the difference between a really poor population in the U.S. and a very wealthy one in child survivorship, maybe as much as 400%. So that's still a factor.
So is your opinion then that it's pretty much impossible to actually make these kind of comparisons?
It's impossible to make the comparisons. And when you do make a statement like poor people have more babies than other people, you are doing it by cherry picking data. And if you make a statement that wealthy people have more babies, you're still probably cherry picking data to some extent. But we can show in many studies of different cultures around the world that again and again, when you hold the variables constant, more resources tends to be correlated with higher reproductive success. Not lower, but higher. So wealthy people are the ones having all the babies is actually the final conclusion.
Thanks for yet another vaguely disconcerting conversation, Greg.
No problem. Anytime.
As usual, if you'd like to read Greg's writing or perhaps argue with him, you can head to his blog at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden. And we'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast at a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today I'm speaking with Barry Glasner. Barry is a professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and the author of 7 books on contemporary social issues, one of them being the national bestseller, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. So this is not simply about people getting a bit freaked out. The term culture of fear is a pervasive and rather overwhelming anxiety.
Yeah, that's right. I think what got me interested in this is that in North America, most people, not all people, but most people live in about the safest places and about the safest times in human history, as far as we know. And yet, so many people are afraid of so many things that they don't really need to be afraid of, where the fears are either very much overblown or almost completely unfounded. And so what I was interested in, and still continue to be very interested in, is how does that happen? And why does it happen? Who benefits? Who pays for it? And why does it persist? So that's why I talk about a culture of fear rather than specific fears.
Right. So although you've recently released an updated version of the book, it was first published in 1999. And that's the point at which some of us were obsessing about Y2K and planes falling out of the sky and such. And you attributed that, at least on some level, to premillennial tension.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of what was going on there is this notion that a huge monumental change was about to happen because now we would have a new digit at the beginning. Instead of a 1, there'd be a 2, something that obviously nobody had ever experienced. It relates to lots of mythic traditions, of course. But mostly what was going on, I think, is a lot of commercial hype, which in my view and a lot of what I've looked at tends to be the case. That is, it's not just that there's something we have inborn or there's some kind of psychological state that predisposes us to think that way, that when big number changes, all kinds of monumental things are going to happen. It's that we're sold that. Sold that by a variety of groups that benefit from it. Mostly, in that case, it was the media who got a lot of great stories out of it. And in some cases, organizations and businesses that were selling products. And that's usually the case in fears and scares that are blown out of proportion, the kind I talk about. There are other groups that are involved as well. Politicians, for example, in the case of Y2K, they really weren't as much. There were some on the fringes, but by and large, not as much. But usually, it's politicians who are trying to stay in office or win elections by fear-mongering. It's advocacy groups that make their money and get memberships and keep their members engaged by fears and scares that horrible things are about to happen or will happen if their organization isn't predominant. And then certain sorts of media outlets that we can talk about in more length.
Well, let's talk about some of the tactics. Now, you mentioned the media. I guess the most stark example to me is the Halloween candy.
Yeah, which was a story that was told for a long time, year after year. And a sociologist named Joel Best is the person who finally utterly debunked it by looking at pretty much every case reported and discovering that either it didn't happen or it was mistold or it was really something that was planned. That is, you know, it was a prank. It was intentional, not always a prank. Sometimes it was quite malicious. But there were very, very few of them, and none of them matched the description in the report. Now, that dissipated, interestingly, by and large, at least from what I've been able to monitor in the past, probably a decade at least. When Halloween comes around, you don't really see those stories anymore, at least that I've been able to see. But before that, you really did. I mean, if you would turn on local TV news, they'd be at the emergency room with the latest case of razor blade in an apple.
So this is an example of one of those bad things which are presented as possible, but they really aren't terribly likely. But they're treated as imminent or looming threats.
Right. And that's one that I would call, even though it was propagated very much by contemporary media, I would still call that an urban legend. I think it fits with the research on urban legend, which I'm very interested in. But I'm more interested in the sorts of fears and scares that are manipulated or set up and perpetuated by particular groups, particular organizations or interests for their own self-interest and are promoted widely. So, for example, one I am very interested in and have talked about a lot is kidnapped children. If you look at the coverage of kidnapped children, it's just persistent. I mean, you can't go very long on cable TV news in the U.S., and this is true in many places, not just the U.S., and not just cable TV news, without stories of kidnapped children. And the notion that is conveyed is that this is a very scary phenomenon. This is something that every parent should worry about. And a lot of the talk, a lot of coverage over the years, you get really extreme statements made that are just highly inaccurate, and not necessarily just by fringe speakers in the media, either by people from advocacy groups that are concerned about this sort of thing. I talk in the new edition of the book of TV news channels talking about 100,000 abductions of strangers every year in the United States. That's actually a direct quote from Bill O'Reilly on his,
right.
on his program. But you get numbers like that thrown around a lot. And the actual number that year he was talking, according to the U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention that keeps track of these things, the actual number was 115 cases of so-called stereotypical kidnappings by non-family members held for a long time or murdered. I've suggested that maybe he or his producers had hired the accountants from Enron or something to compute this, to go from 115 to 100,000. But, you know, when these kinds of numbers thrown around, has a big impact, obviously, on people watching, parents, and so forth. And while I think it would be impossible to demonstrate a direct causal relationship, I also think it's very hard to imagine that what I'm about to say is not the case, namely that there have been considerable parental restrictions on children's activity as a result of these fears and related fears. And those restrictions probably have lots of other ramifications that aren't good. I mean, some we know aren't good. For children to be raised to be fearful of everybody around them, clearly it's not a child-rearing practice that encourages trust.
Well, you mentioned causal effects, and there's a lot of examples of that in your book, people confusing correlation with causation. I'm thinking specifically of the breast cancer abortion debacle.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the common ways that these fears and scares get going, is to say the two things are associated. I think at the beginning of your show, you talked about the alleged correlation between number of childbirths and social class, the inverse correlation by the income.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are just a lot of those that are used to suggest scary outcomes. And as I'm sure you talk about a lot on your show, it's not that hard to come up with a correlation between two things if you manipulate the data, or even if you don't, if you just do enough runs, you're going to get something. And so any politician trying to sell any kind of program, any advocacy group that works at it very hard can do this. And that's one of the main techniques for fear-mongering, along with some others. I'm particularly interested in some that have to do with the kind of storytelling that goes on as well. You know, the use of anecdotes to replace actual evidence is probably what I have found most common in the fear-mongering that I've studied most closely, you know, where you simply take a scary example, and if you can get a person who tells it particularly well, sympathetic person,
right,
it can get a lot of mileage. And that's used in all kinds of fear mongering. In this new edition that came out this year of The Culture of Fear, I looked again at something I'd looked at last time, which is scares about vaccine. And this round, to a certain extent last round too in important ways, but this round, the use of dramatic examples of compelling people, usually so-called vaccine-injured children, was a very important part of that way of telling that story.
Well, actually, maybe you could go back a bit and sort of explain how the vaccine issue happened in the first place, because there's a number of aspects of it.
It's really a fascinating story, in my view. And it goes back to the 80s, really, and to the fears about DPT shot, the diphtheria pertussis shot. And basically what happened was there was a particular person, a woman who was a very effective advocate, won't mention her here, though I do in the book, but she started advocating for this. She managed to get extraordinary publicity. And really what launched the whole scare in a big way was an NBC News special. And in that special, which don't have in front of me the exact date, I think it was 80, in that special there were children on camera who were said to have been damaged by whooping cough vaccine. And they were shown in very sad state, which then made a very dramatic point. This advocacy group, which named itself Dissatisfied Parents Together, or DPT, cleverly, received a huge number of phone calls, memberships from this program, and it grew on itself, as did other groups. Before long, you had, of course, lawsuits, class action lawsuits, and then after a while, as I describe in some detail in the book, the manufacturers were getting out of the business and there was a shortage of vaccine. Now, in some countries where this scare happened, outside the U.S., particularly Japan, there were very serious outbreaks of whooping cough because of the shortage of the vaccine and the scare, so the children were not being vaccinated. In the U.S., it wasn't as serious as that, but it was quite serious to the point where, if we flash forward now to the current period and just very recently as well, there have been lots of studies have shown a significant increase in the number of cases of whooping cough. And the risk of pertussis or whooping cough is about 6 times higher in unvaccinated children. So it's not surprising that that would happen as a result of these scares and panic. But it's really serious business, and it should be a lesson, I believe, going forward in a lot of different ways. I mean, there's a concern now, a well-documented, really, I should say, good reason for this concern about the loss of herd immunity here and for other diseases where the vaccination rates have gotten low. And, you know, that simply means that when you have a large number of immunized people, even those who have not been vaccinated, are safe from a disease because they never come in contact with an infected person, called herd immunity. But there's a very serious concern about a loss of that as a result of these scares and the consequences of them.
Audience, if you have a question about your cultural fears, unacknowledged guilts, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So what you talk about in your book, there's also a focus on bringing out the manageable but not significant issues instead of the larger societal issues that we should be focusing on.
Right. I selected as the subtitle for the book, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Thing. My argument is not that there's nothing to be afraid of or that there shouldn't be fears promoted about something. Though I have to say I don't think fear is the best way to approach most any issue. But sometimes it makes some sense. And we certainly can rationally ask the question, what would it make more sense to be fearful about? And in terms of social issues and social problems, it seems to me that it's not that hard to decide how to answer the question. You answer, if you're being reasonable about it, a good way to answer the question is it's a reasonably large sector of the population susceptible to some serious negative consequence, potentially negative consequence. And there are many areas, of course, where that's true. So I focus a lot in the book about scares relating to children. We talked a few minutes ago about scares about kidnapped kids. But this is at a time when public schools are truly crumbling. I don't mean that metaphorically in many cases, just the physical danger from schools. They're understaffed. Here I'm talking primarily about the U.S., but it goes beyond the U.S., where many children don't have basic nutrition for all of part of the month. We can go on and on about those kinds of dangers. They get relatively little attention in the media and political discourse widely. I mean, you don't open the newspaper and see this, and you certainly don't turn on local TV news or cable TV news and see much about these dangers that are really very serious and that affect a large number of children. But you do routinely see these fears about unlikely dangers or dangers that affect very few children in any kind of serious way or over the a period of time. And so to me, that's really the upshot of all of this, is that we end up with a lot of what I refer to as misdirection. You know, that's a magician's term. If I want to make a coin disappear from my left hand, I need to get you to look at my right hand for a second while I get rid of it. And that can be, misdirection is used. I'm a longtime amateur magician, member of the Magic Castle, and so forth. And I can tell you that misdirection is used very widely in the heyday of magic and large stage magic and vaudeville and so forth. Magicians would make very large objects, cars, elephants, and so forth, disappear using largely misdirection. So it can be used and is used in major cultural and social discussions and controversies by people who have an interest for one reason or another in distracting attention away from other problems, or not just people who have an organized effort to do that, but for less reasoned or less organized objectives.
Well, give me an example of one of those reasons that people would want to misdirect away from a larger societal issue.
I think a particularly common example is in politics. So if I'm running for election and I am not going to be able to propose solutions that are attractive to voters to the large problem, if I can get them focused on a problem that I can address and get them very fearful about it and suggest to them that if they elect me, the problem will be reduced or go away, I'm in great shape. And this is done all the time with crime and crime scares, and often about particular matters and particular issues. So a good example there goes back to something we were talking about a little bit before, and that's the missing children, kidnapped children issue. There's been a lot of legislation as a result of these fears and scares. We could run through quite a few of them. Probably the best known one is what's called the Amber Alert System, which was named for a child who was tragically murdered in Texas in 1996. And the research I've seen, I've looked at a fair amount of it, suggests that the Amber Alert System doesn't work as it's designed. That is, it doesn't save lives of children who are in life-threatening danger. It's at best incidental to the return of most of the hundreds of children who the advocates say that it's been successful for, and it has serious downsides. The one I'm most interested in, because it's my focus over the years, is that it adds to the sense of that we're in a dangerous environment. You know, if you're driving down a highway or freeway and you see this alert, or you hear it on the radio or you see it on TV, it sounds like there's all kinds of kidnapping and horrible things going on often, because you see these things so often. But there are also big financial costs to this, to the states, smaller to the federal government, but substantial, and to police departments having to enact this rather than paying attention to more serious dangers. But it was great for the politicians, right? You know, you're afraid of this, I'm going to get tough on it, and I'm going to do something that will have a big dramatic effect. And if you look at a lot of this legislation that's passed, there's Jessica's Law, there's all sorts of them, you'll find that that's how it came about. Now, let me say, when I say this, any child kidnapping or murder is tragic. There's no question about it. But what I'm talking about is the pervasive fear and the cost and the consequences of those fears and how they're manipulated and who benefits from it.
We have a question from the chat room.
What about something like sudden infant death syndrome? There's so little chance of it happening and so little that can be done to avoid it. Yet it's such an enormous consequence. How does one balance these conflicting tensions? And that's from Greg Layton.
I'll answer the second part of that because I have not researched sudden infant death syndrome per se. So let me address the more general question, which obviously relates to a lot of these kinds of concerns. And I think what's really being raised here is a very important question. If the probability is really low, but the consequence of the probability of a bad outcome, tragic outcome, is really low, but the tragic outcome is horrific, then how do we decide how seriously to take it? What I would suggest is there's great work on that by people who do risk analysis and all sorts of different ways. Not what I do. I make use of some of their work, but that's not what I do. And they suggest all kinds of equations for how you would rationally calculate it. In everyday life, though, people can't often use those methods. When you're putting your child to bed at night. So what do you do? Seems to me what you do is get the best advice on prevention, and the best advice typically in any of these matters is going to be more far-reaching. That is going to have to do with taking care of the child in a reasonable, healthy way more broadly and being attentive and to all kinds of signs of danger and getting help as necessary. So, when you do all of those things, you're probably going to be protecting your child not only from an unlikely danger, but from much more likely dangers as well. This doesn't work in every case, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb.
So now all of these stories were presented with all of these horrific but potentially statistically insignificant actions in the news and in the newspapers and from our family and friends. So what are the repercussions of this?
One repercussion is that we talk about them all the time, with each other, which then makes us even more afraid. So, it makes great conversation. In our conversation today, we've been talking mostly about in formal settings and political campaigns and the media and so forth. But it also, as you're saying, takes place person to person in a family and neighborhood gathering and such. And it's kind of entertainment. Which I find significant. By entertainment, I mean that we tell these stories to each other because they're entertaining and more interesting than talking about the weather or the little story about the neighbor that we've told a thousand times. Much more dramatic, much more interesting. What I find interesting about that is that that's the case also in these more formal cases that I've studied so much. Because why does it work for a politician to get votes? Why does it work for TV news channel to get ratings, to talk about these sorts of stories, because they have high level of drama to them. The narrative is very compelling, and because we are wired to respond to fear in a pretty straightforward way physically. They can be very beneficial in everyday interaction as well, and that helps them spread. Same thing happens online. When you receive these scary emails that people have passed on a million times, why are people passing them on? Usually because they seem credible and they're compelling. They're interesting, they're scary, had an effect on you, why not pass it on to your friend? And I think that's what happens a lot.
But there are additional problems. Like, for example, with health issues, when stories are covered in a way that it seems like if you get cancer, it is a death sentence. What are the consequences of that?
Yeah, that's right. And so, as we know, people stay away from people with cancer almost like it's communicable. Uh, and, And that's a response that a lot of folks have in that kind of situation. You just don't want to be around it. It's terrifying. And also, for people who may be experiencing a symptom, if you're sufficiently fearful that the consequences are going to be the ultimate price, death, as you're mentioning in the way you just put it, a reasonable thing to do is to not find out, right? So, you know, the biggest danger for the individual from this kind of exaggerated sense of danger and a lack of understanding of what is actually likely to happen or what the actual possibilities or odds are, is to avoid getting the kind of treatment or help or prevention that could actually be quite beneficial. That, you know, that's sort of the paradox of this phenomenon, I think, in those kinds of cases.
It also seems like the pseudo-dangers are frightening people away from actually taking part in real life as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's really good research on this, especially with regard to older people. The elderly who watch a lot of television, a bunch of studies look at this, who routinely watch these scary stories on local TV news and elsewhere, stay inside more, get less exercise. That, you know, if you think about it, isn't very surprising. You see these scary things, why would you go out? Especially if you feel vulnerable because, you know, you're not as physically strong as you were at one time, or you don't respond as fast as you did, you're going to have that kind of reaction. In the case of scares about crime broadly and crime against children, dangers to children everywhere you turn, that has certainly influenced parents to keep their children less active. I think that that's probably not very controversial. What might be more controversial is how, or less well documented, is how well we can relate that to other outcomes, such as increased weight among children, so-called childhood obesity and such, but restrictions on activity, it would seem reasonable, at least to hypothesize, that that has something to do with those other negative outcomes. One thing that we can say for certain, though, is if you're held back from participating in your community because of your fears or your parents' fears or others who are influential on you, you're just not going to be as engaged in the civic life of the community, and you're going to be more receptive to campaigns that are oriented towards the argument that if you vote a particular way or you buy a particular product, that you will feel safer. And those are not necessarily the best products or the best policies.
And we have a question from the chat room.
Do you consider fear-mongering over terrorism to be a subset of fear-mongering over crime, or is it a distinct phenomenon? That's from Cusino Macuel.
Yes. In the new edition of The Culture of Fear, I spend a lot of space on fear of terrorism. And I think there's been a very significant change that the questioner is raising. So before September 11, 2001, the basic narrative of fear in the U.S. especially, in North America broadly, the basic narrative was that it goes something like this. There are monsters among us, what I call the sick society narrative. You know, you remember all the scares were about adolescent males mostly. It took a whole variety of forms, but this notion of the super predator young adolescent in cities and then suburbs, and it was about, there were a lot of scares about adolescent mothers, claims that pregnant teenagers were destroying the country and wrecking the economy and such, that sorts of things that I documented in a lot of detail in the first edition of the book. So after 9/11, 2001. That narrative pretty quickly shifted from there are monsters among us to foreign terrorists want to destroy us. And that is a shift that has very significant outcomes in certain ways for certain sorts of, for certain people. For example, for teenagers, for adolescent males, they're no longer, since 9/11, the focus of a lot of the fear-mongering. And on the flip side of that, who is? Well, right, people who are perceived as foreign, especially Middle Eastern, people from a variety of ethnic and national groups. And that kind of collective fear coalesced pretty quickly, but then had all kinds of other ramifications. So in the U.S., there was, and of course continues to be, a whole system of perpetual fear-mongering that takes a variety of forms. The most evident to anybody who travels by air in the U.S. is the color-coded terror alert system, which has not gotten as much play since the Obama administration has been in office, but is still very much there, you know, and you have this color chart that reminds the populace continually, graphically, that we're always in danger, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but that it's a constant, endless danger. And so this notion, this shift, as I would put it, the shift in the basic fear narrative has been pretty profound.
Now, we had a question submitted before the show, but it turns out that the person who submitted it was able to be with us in the studio today. So this question is from Naomi Baker from Houston.
If you've ever flown Southwest Airlines, you know that the flight attendants frequently threaten to throw noisy babies out the airlock or do silly things like sing the standard announcements. About a month after 9/11, a prominent national newspaper criticized Southwest for this practice. The reporter claimed that he had lost several friends to the terror attacks and that Southwest was making flying unsafe by doing this. Have you seen this in other areas, and what are your comments on that?
Yeah, you know, I remember that at the time. What the answer to your question is, this happened in a variety of areas. That was a particularly striking example, it seems to me. But there were a variety of others where anything that made light of expansive fear and fear about terrorists attacking again at any moment was considered either unpatriotic or downright dangerous. Now, there's certain places where I think that that's reasonable. You know, if you are going through airline security and you make a joke about having a bomb with you, they ought to do something about it. But this was happening. This kind of overreaction that you're describing was happening widely for quite a while after 9/11/01. And I think it's dissipated a lot, but I think there still is that sense around.
And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by University of Florida researcher Kevin Folta. We'll find out what an expert in plant genomics thinks about the claims and controversies surrounding genetically modified foods. And on Speaking Up, we talk to singer-songwriter Monty Harper about songs from The Final Frontier, his new collection of science-themed kids' music. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today's guest is Barry Glassner, sociologist and author of The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. And we have a question from the chat room.
When can fear be a positive motivator? When should we trust our own fears? And that's from Anxious Medic.
Great name. When should we? I think, again, that we make it very complicated, and the answer isn't that hard to come by. When there's real danger, you know, if that sounds too simple, I actually don't think it is. You need to assess whether what you're fearful of has a reasonable probability based on good evidence. And by probability, I don't mean just the statistical sort, though that's very important. Risk analysis and other efforts can help nail that down. But I mean more than that. So, for example, am I going to be concerned about the airplane flight I'm about to take? Well, you know, a lot of people are fearful because of all kinds of scary stories about airline crashes. Fortunately, recently there haven't been a lot of those stories, but we go through periods often when there are. And what happens is people, when there are a lot of those stories at once, or some predominant scare about airline travel, is people stop flying as much. For shorter trips, they're more likely to take cars, and therefore are more likely to die or be seriously injured in a car accident than they would be if they took the airline flight. So, you know, what I think we need to say to ourselves is, have we gotten afraid of something that is then making us behave in an actually more dangerous way? And the flip side of that is, how do we know when the opposite is true? Well, when there are actual dangers around that we're not paying attention to or that we're ignoring conveniently. So this person signs an anxious medic. People who avoid kinds of preventive medical tests that they can afford that are made available to them publicly because they don't want to hear the news is a great example, or because they're afraid of the disease. I mentioned earlier one that I think is a really important one to keep in mind right now, and that is getting children vaccinated and not being susceptible to the very widespread fear and scare campaigns about vaccination. And then I think we're able to conduct our lives in ways that are not only more reasonable, but a lot safer.
Let's start with the fact that most people really don't want to do a lot of research, generally.
Yeah.
So can widespread publicity of reassuring real statistics, can they ever really compete with any of the media about the pseudo-dangers?
You know, I'm of two minds about that. Let me say something encouraging and positive first, which is what I mostly feel. In my research, I was really reassured a lot by how often it was that journalists, not people like me, not social scientists or physical science, biological science, but journalists, working journalists, including in media outlets, I would never have expected. They were the ones who debunked these fears and scares. And so my answer to your question is encouraging more of that, being receptive to that, meaning commending the publication, commending the journalist when it happens. Going in, if you're a young person considering journalism, taking this to heart, or if you are a journalist, taking this to heart and engaging in this kind of activity, can have a big effect. So some of these fears and scares were debunked in the very media outlets that spread them, and it pretty much put an end to the scare. Crack babies is one example of that, if you remember that scare in the U.S., which was a big one. And the new edition of Culture Fair, I write a lot about what happened there. But media themselves that had been engaged in really intense fear-mongering about these children just flipped it over and debunked them with big effects, I think, and that the scare pretty much disappeared. That's just one example. But there are a lot of examples like that. So on the one hand, yeah, I'm really encouraged. When I say I'm of two minds, what I mean is it doesn't happen very much, actually. And fears and scares that are blown out of proportion continue for long periods of time. And it's very hard for people who are busy with other things, you know, they have their lives and their own work and so forth, to sort them out. But what I always tell people about that is it's not as hard as you think. For many that we've talked about during this program, for instance, all you need is a little basic knowledge of where to find the reality to be able to check these things out yourself. You know, if you hear that some vaccine is terribly dangerous, go see what the pediatric societies are saying about it. They actually know. They are able to cite very reliable research and tell you what the actual danger is. You can find that online in about 3 minutes. So it's actually not as hard as people think with a lot of these scares.
And then would you suggest, once you find out the real statistics and the real information, that you tell everybody, you start your own counter campaign?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that you, as we like to say, talk back and talk back to the groups that are providing the fears and scares. My main advice about politicians is, and I follow this, I will never vote for someone who engages in a fear campaign, even if I like everything else they're doing. I'll either stay home or I'll vote for their opponent if I'm close enough to their position. In the U.S., we had a great example of somebody winning on the opposite of fear campaigning, and that was Barack Obama. He engaged in a little bit, but not much. The campaign was pretty fear-free. So it is possible to do it. And in local elections, it's often a stark choice between the fear-mongering campaign and one or two others.
And that's our time. Thanks very much for being here, Barry.
Thanks for having me on.
And for more of Barry, visit barryglassner.com. And for more of us, visit skepticallyspeaking.com. There you will find all the links you need to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike Moraz from the Actually Speaking podcast. One question I get asked a lot is, how can skeptics best promote critical thinking among family and friends? What can we reasonably do to share this fundamental aspect of our skeptical lifestyle? Unfortunately, our first instinct is often to turn to a more textbook approach. Resorting to the scientific method and expecting people to adopt a more research-based approach to life decisions just isn't very realistic. In fact, it'll probably turn them off. Instead, we need to tap into what is already there in their own lives and educate by example. Remember, critical thinking isn't a process of thinking really long and hard about something, although that's the impression that many people have. Critical thinking is simply a process of evaluating information with minimal bias. The more we can remove biases from our thinking, the greater the likelihood that our decisions will be based on knowledge and evidence. We can encourage this in two ways. The first is to identify and acknowledge areas where family and friends are already thinking critically and encourage them to apply that process to new areas of their life. You'd be surprised how much critical thinking is actually going on around you when you expand your view of its application. Let go of your notion that critical thinking lies solely in the domain of science, and you'll see that the unbiased evaluation of information is actually happening in areas like consumer decisions, literature, journalism, politics, therapy, counseling, and in many common human interactions. Find examples wherever you can. Help others recognize the hidden pockets of critical thought already in use in their own lives, and then encourage them to apply it in new areas. Wherever possible, show others what they're doing right, instead of only pointing out what they're doing wrong. The second is to be the best example of critical thinking you can possibly be. Demonstrate critical thinking in your own decision-making process and share that freely in order to allow others to slowly become familiar with what the process looks like and the benefits it presents. Demonstrate how you can both formulate and change your own positions and decisions based on new information. Being right is nice, but family and friends will learn far more about critical thinking when they see how you handle being wrong.
Skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we do interviews with experts on everything from vitamins to paranormal research to evolution to nuclear power. But we also do interviews with people like you. Maybe you've done some research into a specific alternative health treatment and you want to share what you've learned. Or you've written a blog post on some questionable story that's been in the news and you think that people should know about it. Or you've found a creative way to talk to your children about science and you think that it could work for other parents. Or there's a skeptical project that you've been working on and it's time for some promotion. Perhaps you've had an experience where critical thinking saved your bacon and you think that the story might be valuable to other people. These are all great topics for speaking up. You bring the idea and we'll work with you to make sure that your piece is radio ready. Just send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, give us a bit of information about your topic, and we'll contact you.
All of us here at Skeptically Speaking are committed to spreading the wonders of science and critical thought. We want to encourage your efforts, and in turn, your segment encourages others. Because we all need some support and a gentle nudge now and then to keep questioning everything.